It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. Islamic State executioner identified. Media reports say the masked Islamic State militant who appeared in several videos of hostage beheadings has been tentatively identified, but security sources caution the reports may not be accurate. Reports quote friends of Mohammed Emwazi as saying they believe he is the tall, London-accented speaker known as Jihadi John. John Garson is professor of national security studies at King's College London.
I think if this is the man concerned, if he has been unmasked now, that is literally a useful thing. He's unmasked. We understand who he is. Kuwaiti-born British resident, allegedly from a reasonably well-off family, a graduate, somebody with many opportunities in life, not a dispossessed person at all.
European intelligence sources are refusing to confirm the identification. A U.S. National Security Council spokeswoman would not confirm or deny the reports about the identity of Jihadi John. She says U.S. authorities are working closely with international partners, including Britain, to bring the murderers to justice. An activist group says a number of Assyrian Christians kidnapped by Islamic State militants in northeastern Syria is now up to at least 220. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the fighters captured people over the past 3 days while taking control of 10 villages in Hasaka province. Ukrainian troops have begun withdrawing artillery from a frontline eastern village near the devastated town of Debaltseve. It is all done under the watchful eye of European monitors who are overseeing a ceasefire deal reached a little over 2 weeks ago. This is VOA News. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is warning Western countries against imposing more sanctions on Moscow. He says threats of additional sanctions show the West is opposed to following through on a truce for eastern Ukraine. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg spoke Thursday about the truce.
And I welcome the recent indications of reduced fighting in Ukraine, and we hope that the ceasefire now finally is going to be respected.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. A Saudi man accused of being an early leader of al-Qaeda was convicted on 4 counts of conspiracy in connection with the 1998 bombings of 2 U.S. embassies in East Africa. 52-year-old Khalid al-Fawaz was found guilty Thursday by a jury in New York. The August 1998 bombings of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania killed 224 people. Al-Fawaz faces a maximum sentence of life in prison. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan paid a surprise visit on Thursday to the country's northeast, the epicenter of the Boko Haram insurgency. The president met with Nigerian troops in Bag and Mube, 2 towns the army recently recaptured from the insurgents. But violence in that region continued Thursday. Witnesses say a suicide bomber killed at least 19 people in the Borno state town of Biu, the site of previous attacks claimed by Boko Haram. A second person attempted a suicide bombing in the same area, but was killed before he could detonate his explosives. U.S. and Cuban officials will meet today in Washington for a second round of talks to discuss the process for restoring diplomatic ties. Pam Dawkins has more.
As the two sides prepare to discuss diplomatic relations, there are continued questions about Cuba's human rights record, as well as its designation by the U.S. as a state sponsor of terrorism. Democratic Congressman Elliot Engel is part of a U.S. delegation that recently visited Cuba.
I believe the ball is now in the Cuban government's court to respond by ending the harassment of political activists and releasing political prisoners.
As Secretary of State John Kerry testified before a House panel Wednesday, Kerry said Cuba should be judged by its future actions. Pam Dawkins, the State Department.
The U.S. Federal Communications Commission voted 3-2 Thursday in favor of what's called net neutrality, allowing wealthy internet providers to have an advantage over smaller companies that they no longer can have. The decision means the internet in the U.S. will be treated like a public utility. Big-name content providers, such as Amazon and Facebook, can no longer pay more money to broadband providers to send material faster to customers than the smaller content providers. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, February 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberia's president is grateful for U.S. support during her country's Ebola crisis.
You did not run from Liberia. With many of our global challenges, America stood up, and America stood with us.
That's Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf speaking Thursday in Washington, D.C. Ghana's president promises to solve the country's chronic electricity problem, but the opposition says the government has mismanaged the current system. Civil society groups at the South Sudan peace talks in Ethiopia want peace now. And Nigeria's Electoral Commission reassures the public about the March 28 election.
We have reached a very comfortable level, in the sense that we have distributed not less than 76.98% of the permanent voter cast nationwide as at 2 days ago.
Nick Dazan is the Deputy Director for Public Affairs of Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission. A top U.S. official says Nigeria's March 28 election is a bellwether for Africa. And Western students are outsourcing their homework to Kenya. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's Sports and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. On her first trip to Washington since Liberia declared a state of emergency over the Ebola outbreak last July, President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf acknowledged the difference that America's involvement made in the fight against the deadly virus. She says the United States stood with her people and she will forever be grateful. She also discussed the need for economic reconstruction and sustained investment in West Africa's public health infrastructure to help prevent future outbreaks. VOA's Mariama Diallo was among those to hear President Sirleaf's remarks.
7 months after the Ebola outbreak turned Liberia upside down, President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf came to say thanks to a country she says did so much.
You did not run from Liberia. With many of our global challenges, America stood up and America stood with us.
Late last year, the Ebola-stricken nations of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea saw about 800 new cases a week. Of those afflicted by the deadly virus, Liberia, where about 4,000 people have died, is seen as the most advanced in curbing the disease's spread. Earlier this month, children lined up again to go back to school, and borders between the neighboring countries reopened. But President Sirleaf says as her country celebrates success, the fight is not over.
We are transitioning from treatment to prevention with the support of over 100 partners from 26 countries. Liberia's only 218 medical doctors and 5,234 nurses to serve a population of 4.3 million. And we know that these facts will not change overnight.
U.S. Senator Chris Coons, who invited President Sirleaf to speak at the U.S. Senate offices, visited Liberia during the height of the outbreak.
One of the hardest things for leaders to do is to ask for help. They tend to think doing so is a sign of weakness. But the truth is, what it really signals is dedication and strength.
As Liberia and neighboring countries see progress, President Barack Obama recently said most of the 3,000 troops deployed to West Africa to help contain Ebola will be back in the U.S. by the end of April. But he's not yet declaring it mission accomplished until the virus is extinguished.
Our focus now is getting to zero, because as long as there's even one case of Ebola that's active out there, risks still exist. Every case is an ember that, if not contained, can light a new fire.
This week, the United Nations called for more funding support for the next phase of bringing the number of cases down to zero.
One of the biggest risks we face right now is that new financing for this response is falling faster than the new cases.
And as long as the virus is there, he says, it can spread and escalate. In Washington, Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Nigeria's Independent Electoral Commission, INEC, has reassured prospective voters that the rescheduled March 28 election will proceed as planned, despite concerns that the vote could be postponed again for security reasons. The commission postponed the general election originally planned for February 14 to March 28, citing security challenges in parts of the country's north, where Boko Haram militants often attack civilians. Nick Dazan, INEC's Deputy Director for Public Affairs, tells reporter Peter Clotty that the electoral body is using the election postponement period to strengthen the electoral system to ensure a transparent, credible, free and fair election.
We are very, very, very ready to conduct the elections scheduled for 28 March and 11 April. I say this informed by the fact that in terms of the distribution of the permanent voter cards, we have reached a very comfortable level in the sense that we have distributed not less than 76.98% of the permanent voter cards nationwide as at 2 days ago. Sensitive materials, that is ballot papers, which we collected from the vendors or contractors since February 12th, have also been distributed to the states and are at the vaults of the Central Bank of Nigeria in each of the states awaiting distribution on election day. We have also intensified training of ad hoc staff, especially with respect to the use of the card reader.
Some opposition groups, including the main opposition, All Progressive Congress, have expressed concern that there is a chance the election could be delayed, and they said they would not tolerate any more election delay. How do you react to such expressions of concern from such groups in the country?
Well, on our own part, as a commission, we have always said, even after the time we were asked or we were given a security advisory, security agencies could not guarantee or secure the elections. Even after that time, we were ready for the elections. We have used the period of extension to further perfect the processes we have put in place. And for us, we want to restate that as at now, we are ready for the elections in terms of the materials we have deployed, in terms of training, in terms of even the psychology and motivation of our staff.
If the card readers break down, does INEC have plan B to authenticate prospective voters before they cast their ballot?
Well, let me say this. Based on our own projections, we have about 120,000 polling units on the ground as it is. And we are likely going to create what we call voting centers, you know, during the elections in addition to the polling units. Now, beyond that, the commission also had an arrangement with the political parties. Whereby if, for example, an election is taking place in a polling unit and the card reader malfunctions, then we will now reconfigure a spare and use it to accredit. But even where the spare card reader still malfunctions, then the election in that polling unit will not take place until the next day. So that is the arrangement.
Nick Dazan is the Deputy Director for Public Affairs of Nigeria's Independent Electoral Commission. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. Nigeria's upcoming national election is a bellwether for the continent, says a top U.S. State Department official who notes the United States is working with every one of the dozen African nations planning an election in the next 2 years. Assistant Secretary of State Linda Thomas-Greenfield says top Nigerian officials assure her that the vote will go ahead as scheduled on March 28. VOA's Anita Powell files from Johannesburg.
Nigeria is Africa's most populous nation, its biggest economy, and the continent's top oil producer. And so it follows that everyone, including top U.S. officials, are watching as Nigeria plans to hold a key national election. The vote was set for this month, but was moved back when the military said it would not be able to provide sufficient security amid fighting the extremist Boko Haram group, which has waged a war of terror in the nation's north. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Linda Thomas-Greenfield told reporters this week she has been personally assured by top Nigerian officials that the vote will be held in late March.
We're all watching this election. This election will be a bellwether for the entire continent. The world is watching, the continent is watching, Nigeria's neighbors are watching this election, and our hope is that the election will be free and fair, that it will be transparent, it will be peaceful, and that the results of the election will reflect the will of the people of Nigeria.
She noted the United States is working with every single one of the dozen or so African nations planning to hold elections this year and in 2016, including Burundi and Ethiopia. She said another U.S. concern is the recent trend of African leaders changing the constitution to extend their term limits, as Democratic Republic of Congo President Joseph Kabila may be trying to do.
Our policy broadly has been one of supporting term limits and supporting the change that Africans themselves have indicated that they want. So we're not just pressuring President Kabila to honor the constitution of your country. We're pressing other countries as well to honor their constitutions, because this is what we hear the people of Africa want.
Nigeria votes March 28th. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. Ghanaian President John Dramani Mahama said his government will correct the country's chronic electricity problem. Speaking Thursday to the country's parliament in a State of the Nation address, Mr. Mahama said all Ghanaians are feeling the pinch of the power crisis, and even businesses and industries are threatening to lay off workers. Boachi Ajako is former campaign manager for the main opposition National Patriotic Party leader, Nana Akufo-Addo. He says Ghana is having electricity problems because the government is not managing the current system well.
Our position is that this three-year rolling crisis is needless. Needless in the sense that at the end of 2008, when President Kufuor and the MPP were leaving office, we had an installed capacity of 2,800 megawatts, and the system peak demand projected to now was expected to be 2,700 megawatts, thereabouts. So why are we having a three-year crisis? We are having a three-year crisis simply because the energy sector has been grossly mismanaged.
To the president's credit, and I'm sure some people would agree with what the president said, that the power crisis, the electricity crisis, is the result of Ghana's economic success over the last decade.
That is totally false. If you look at our power profile, it is the household sector that consumes most of our power, not industry. Not industry. How do you say you've succeeded economically when your growth of rate drops from 14% to 3.9%? It is pure mismanagement. The plant capacity is there. If you can't buy $100 million worth of crude for your thermal plant, how do you attribute to it to economic success?
The other side of it is that some people say that the new Patriotic Party, when it was in power, also made similar promises, and the Ghanaian electricity problem was never solved. So why are you criticizing the current government?
I beg to differ. The facts speak differently. When President Kufuor was faced with the crisis in 2006, guess what? He took emergency measures. We brought in 126 megawatts of an emergency plant. We brought in the mine reserves. We started the Bui Dam. We started Osono plant. Altogether, by the time he was leaving office, that capacity had grown from 1,180 megawatts to 2,800 megawatts. So he added over 1,400 megawatts to capacity. So why are we having a crisis? We're having a crisis because we're not managing the system well.
Is it true that all this is happening because this is election politics and then eventually?
As I sit with you, my power is off for the next 24 hours. There are barbers who can't work, seamstresses who can't work, welders who can't work, hairdressers who can't work. Factories are laying off workers. The mines have laid off over 4,000 workers as of last month. What is electioneering about it? The people of this country are feeling the pinch.
Boachi Ajako is a former campaign manager for Ghanaian opposition leader Nana Akufo-Addo. He was speaking with me from the capital, Accra. Civil society delegates at the South Sudan peace talks in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, say negotiators for the two warring parties are putting forward unrealistic demands. Government and rebel delegates have been negotiating since Monday, but it appears neither side is willing to compromise on issues of security and finance. John Tanza of VOA's South Sudan in Focus program reports from Addis Ababa.
Several groups from the diaspora in South Sudan are attending talks as independent observers. They hope to contribute their ideas on what the future government of South Sudan should look like. James Emmanuel Oriema represents civil society groups in exile. He says some delegates at the talks have no knowledge of the root causes of the violence which tore the country apart in December last year.
You find that there is an intellectual gap, whereby you find sometimes people who have been brought within the committee, they don't have the know-how. They don't have any specialization in the subject matters. And that really retard the discussions to move the peace talk forward.
Bishop Enoch Tombe is the leader of the faith-based groups observing the process. He says changes in negotiators at the table have slowed the progress at the talks.
In this final session, what I've seen is that both parties, particularly the government and the opposition, they have brought their technical people. And of course, some of them are completely new in this process. So it looks like there was an assumption that when you just bring an expert, he will understand quickly and then they will just solve the problem.
President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar must endorse any final recommendations made by the negotiators at the talks. Contested issues such as security arrangement, wealth sharing and power sharing have yet to be worked out. Emmanuel says some delegates negotiating such delicate issues as reconciliation and justice are stuck because they don't have the green light from their leaders to make on-the-spot decisions about compromises.
The other observation also which has been there is that some members within the committee, they have not been really given mandate even to talk on some other subject. And this has really affected so much because they have to go back to consult and the consultation is becoming too much.
The on-again, off-again peace talks have been dragging on for more than a year. The two warring parties signed several documents on cessation of hostilities, but those agreements have been violated repeatedly by both sides. Machar is in Addis Ababa. President Kiir is yet to arrive. Both leaders are expected to join the delegates next week and finalize the negotiation process. For VOA News, I'm John Tanza, reporting from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa.
Freelance writers in Kenya may be contributing more to academic research in the United States and Europe than we know. For a fee, Kenyans are increasingly writing assignments for students abroad. VOA's Gabe Jaslow reports on how this academic outsourcing raises all kinds of ethical issues, while writers say the money is too good to turn down.
On the University of Nairobi campus, talent is on sale. Signs like these advertise for researchers or online writers, code words for a service writing essays for paying students at universities around the world. Agri Iso has been in the academic writing business since 2010. As a freelancer, he can work wherever he wants. He gets his assignments through websites that post requests from students around the world.
This one is writing. The course level here is college, level 1, 2, freshman, or a sophomore student. And then the topic category is business. The title is international business. And then there's a number of pages, because you're paid by the number of pages you write.
He says he has written assignments for undergrads, master's students, even the occasional PhD.
And the topics are broad. The social sciences and the sciences, especially biology, law, business, marketing, psychology, sociology.
The work calls for a degree of creativity. Iso once had to write a first-person experience for a student trying to get into a nursing program in California.
That was VOA's Gabe Jaslow reporting. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Owoma reporting from Johannesburg. A very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Mali beat Guinea 2-1 in the second semi-final at the Africa Under-17 Championships in Niamey, Niger on Thursday. On Sunday, FIFA Under-17 World Cup champions Nigeria play Guinea in the bronze medal playoff before South Africa engage Mali in the final. In athletics, returning to the national team after many years, South Africa 5,000-meter record holder Shadrach Hoff recently placed third at the Best Men Tax 10-kilometer race at the University of Pretoria. He looks forward to the World Cross Country Championships in China next month.
I just want to thank my coach, Donovan Wright, and his wife, Marata. Those two people, they were actually my parents for the past 4 years now. I came back from injury. My injury was hamstring. I've got some of the best physios now working with me. A Kenyan guy called Chir. And then there's a lady, Andrea, the new girl for my linotherapy.
You recently made the team for World Cross Country. After many, many years, more than 10, 15 years.
You know, Mark, that's a very good question from you. I made the last South African team in 1999. So it's a long step, but you know, they said I'm old, but I don't believe in that. So that I'm 42 now. That's why I said I've turned to the Kenyan ways. Because if I went to Kenya, I trained in Kenya, but the mistake I did all this time, I came back to South Africa. I live the good life again because of, you know, here in South Africa, everything is for free. Because of here, we eat steak, then we forget. So I went back to the Kenyan ways, you know, eating ugali, go to my veggies and all those kind of things. And then, that method is working for me now.
So we hope to see you at the World Cross Country.
Definitely, I will be there. And then, you know, the people ask me a question because of I was on a Two Oceans program, 56K. And then they asked the question, will I feature at Worlds? And then, you know, one of the journalists asked me that. And then I was asking him, why is he not asking Mokoka and Precious, the younger boys? But, you know, they think I'm going to World just to put on the tracksuit and whatever. But I'm going to show them at Worlds I'm going to compete.
Okay.
That was Shadrach Hoff, the South Africa 5,000-meter record holder, speaking at the High Performance Center, University of Pretoria, in the South African capital, Tshwane. Finally, South Africa play West Indies at the Cricket World Cup in Sydney, Australia, today, Friday, while Zimbabwe challenge Pakistan in Brisbane on Sunday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a very good weekend. It's time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 27th. On this day in 1988, Debbie Thomas became the first African-American figure skater to win a medal of bronze at the Winter Olympics in Calgary, Canada. Thomas also won the World Figure Skating Championship in 1986. Debbie Thomas went on to become a medical doctor. Also, on this day in 1853, the first black YMCA was organized in Washington, D.C. by Anthony Bowen. Back then, African-Americans were excluded from the existing YMCAs. On this day in 1902, African-American and world-renowned opera singer Miriam Anderson was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. She went on to be the first African-American to perform at the White House. Also, on this day in 1869, the U.S. Congress adopted the 15th Constitutional Amendment. It made it illegal for the United States or any local or state government to deny or abridge the right to vote on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. On this day in African history, in 1999, voters in Nigeria elected Olusegun Obasanjo president to end 15 years of military rule. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 27th. Congratulations to Shadrach Ndara Marira of Nairobi, Kenya, Mohamed Baksaw Kroma of Freetown, Sierra Leone, and Okitaya Santo of the University of Juba in South Sudan. You are the winners of our February 26th question, who did Muhammad Ali or Cassius Clay beat in 1964 to become the world heavyweight boxing champion? The answer, Sonny Liston. Now here is our question for today, February 27th. Who started the idea to celebrate Black History Month in the United States? Once again, who started the idea to celebrate Black History Month in the United States? Send your answers to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. And that's it for this Friday, February 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Jackson Vunganyi, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post-editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Jim Harmon, I'm James Butty, Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good weekend.